May it please the court.
You may proceed.
First, I would like to say how honored I am to be back here. And I have to say the view from the podium is much better than having to be stuck in the back row. Now, as relates to the merits of this case, one of the most important things I've learned is that this court does not see criminal proceedings as merely a game or a competition with winners and losers, but views the criminal process as a, quote, quest for truth in a fair and just forum. To this end, this court promulgated Rule 2503, which this court has said that the purpose was, quote, to permit a party to prepare for trial, to eliminate surprise, and to afford the defendant with information with which to formulate a defense to meet opposing evidence. This rule thus requires, as is relevant to this case, that the state disclose defense counsel's written statements on a written motion from defense counsel, and also that these would be any written statements that are within the possession of the state, but also that the state has the duty to seek with diligence any of these statements that would be within the possession of any other governmental personnel. And again, this state, the rule imposes an affirmative duty on counsel or on the prosecutor to do this. So based on this rule, in this case, this court must answer three questions. First, did the state violate Rule 2503? And second, if it did this late disclosure create fundamental unfairness in this case where the trial court took no remedy to alleviate any of the late disclosure's unfairness? And third, if so, what was the appropriate sanction that the trial court should have imposed? And so turning to the first question in terms of whether or not a violation occurred. Again, the rule expressly states that the prosecutor must use diligence to seek out the records that are within the control or possession of other governmental personnel. And so one of the questions this court may have is the Warren County Sheriff's Department this kind of other governmental personnel? And I would say it is. This court in Meriwether, in fact, even found that the Illinois police, which would not be an agent of the Missouri police or an agent of the Missouri prosecutor, that came under this other personnel, other governmental personnel requirement. And so the state here in their brief would like this court to adopt a standard that would say that it would only be an other governmental personnel if it was an agent of the prosecutor. But that's not what this court has said, and that's really not what the rule anticipates, because the rule anticipates that the criminal defendant will basically know the case that the state has, know what it is facing. And so that would include both exculpatory and inculpatory evidence. And so that's where if the state is seeking this inculpatory evidence from government personnel and can easily find this evidence, that's what the rule anticipates is really being looked at here, and really that's what the state is having to seek with diligence.
So opposing counsel seems to take the position that only if he knew that there was something out there to get did he have an obligation to get it and provide it.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the state's position, but this court has held that the prosecutor really has to use diligence to search for the records that would be available. And so here, there's no indication that the prosecutor didn't know that these phone records would be available. In fact, the prosecutor's excuse for it was just that he had a very busy schedule and hadn't had time to look for them yet, and basically wanted to review them before he disclosed them. And so these phone calls, they're routinely used in prosecution. It's not something that would be a third party who made a statement that the defendant made a statement to a third party that unexpectedly became disclosed. These sorts of jailhouse phone calls are routine, they're easily obtainable, and in fact, in this case, the prosecutor's office for Warren County is in the same building as the Warren County Sheriff's Office.
If you assume it's a violation of the rule and assume that the prosecutor could have obtained this upon request if he had done so previously in any sort of timely manner, I know you didn't request a continuance. What if the trial judge would have just granted a continuance without a request? Would that have been within the trial court's discretion?
I think that would have been in the trial court's discretion. I think that certainly an appeal still could have been sought, mm-hmm. but I think that it would have been in the trial court's discretion to do so.
And so that, if the trial court could have done that, even if you're correct that there's a clear rule violation, how could your client be prejudiced if he just had a retrial and the state could use this statement again?
Well, here I don't know if there's an issue of prejudice. I think the issue is really what is the appropriate remedy based on this willful violation? Because certainly...
Well, I thought the record suggested that it wasn't a willful violation, that it wasn't an intentional violation.
It is an intentional violation, Your Honor. And so I think there's a difference between, for example, the Western District States v. Johnson, or the Eastern District State v. Johnson, where it was a sabotage. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the prosecutor said, I actually withheld these records and knew about them, had them, and didn't disclose them. Mm-hmm. That is bad faith. Mm-hmm. Here, however, it's not bad faith, but it still is intentional because the prosecutor had the duty to diligently search for them and basically just delayed that, basically said, I have a really busy schedule, and so I may have 5 months to prepare for this case, but I'm going to delay requesting these records to the extent that I'm only going to give defense counsel 3 days when her office is closed. And so it's still willful that...
Do we know when the prosecutor got the records? Because clearly the prosecutor had time to listen to a bunch of phone calls and choose to not even reveal the others, which the rule also required, but that must have taken some time.
Correct, Your Honor. I would say that would have taken some time, but we don't know exactly when the prosecutor requested them. We know the prosecutor said, I turned over the calls as soon as I had them, and so it may be that the prosecutor requested them on a Wednesday and then got them on a Thursday, but that isn't in the record exactly when they were requested.
Does Meriwether say it's the state's burden to prove they acted with due diligence?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so here I would say that the state didn't prove anything. They didn't offer any evidence at all of why they didn't try to obtain these records earlier. The only reason they gave is that they had a very busy schedule. But a very busy schedule doesn't excuse obtaining records, requesting records that they could have and that they knew they were going to request at some point.
The state cites a case, State v. Pitchford, 2017, a Court of Appeals case, in which no discovery violation was found, and it involved disclosure of defendant's jail cell recordings on the morning of trial, and no discovery violation was found. How do you distinguish that case?
So in Pitchford, I think the main distinguishing fact is that no motion for discovery was ever filed by defense counsel. And so with no motion for discovery ever filed, there wasn't a discovery violation. There was no 2503 motion that was filed. And so the prosecutor under that case had no duty to take this, had no affirmative duty to actually seek out these records. The Pitchford court did in dicta say, well, that wouldn't have mattered. Even had there been a motion that was filed, we still wouldn't have found that there was prejudice. And I would say that dicta is just incorrect. And so in terms of distinguishing it, I would say the outcome of that case was correct because there was no motion filed. But the dicta that suggests that even if it was, that the outcome would be the same, I would say that this court needs to distinguish and overrule that dicta.
How would the outcome in this case been affected if your client would have been given a week continuance?
So again, I think in terms of whether or not it was fundamental unfairness, I think that we could say if she had been given some sort of continuance, whatever she had requested, perhaps that fundamental unfairness wouldn't have been a question. But I think there's the third part of the analysis, and the third part is what is the appropriate sanction? And under Rule 2518, for a willful violation, the trial court may sanction, or a court may sanction an attorney for such willful discovery violations. And so the last question that this court has to answer is, if there is fundamental unfairness that existed because of this late disclosure, what's the appropriate sanction? And for something like this, again, where maybe it's not bad faith, but certainly it's a willful delay and it's still a willful lack of adherence to the rule, that I would say the appropriate sanction is to exclude the phone calls, because if not, this is what the state is going to hear. The state's going to hear that they can continue to delay looking for records that are easily obtainable. They can basically disclose these at the last minute and not give defense counsel a chance to adequately prepare. And the only thing that happens is that there's a continuance. And so what reason would the state have to actually comply with the rule in that case?
But what if the shoe is on the other foot? Okay, and that same scenario that you just gave, and what was disclosed was an alibi on Thursday. And there was no request by the state to continue, and they just sought to exclude it. If we were to agree with you in your position here, then the court would abuse its discretion if they didn't exclude the alibi witness.
If that was also, and I'm not as certain about the discovery, but I know the state also can file motions of discovery on defendant. And if defendant had a duty to disclose that, and if there's a timeliness duty and a diligence duty, and defense counsel didn't do that, I would agree with you, because again, I think it's looking at the criminal proceedings as trying to make that fair and trying to make that just and trying to make that an even playing field. So whether or not defense counsel is violating rules or whether the state is violating the rules, I would hope that the court would come to the same conclusion.
Don't the cases also draw a distinction between failure to disclose just regular discovery and failure to disclose inculpatory statements by the defendant? In State versus Willis, the Court of Appeals said you can distinguish other cases on that basis, and that we find that where the statement that was not produced was inculpatory, appellant's failure to ask for a continuance has no bearing on whether the state's discovery violation resulted in fundamental unfairness to appellant. We emphasized failure to produce a statement of the accused is in a different category from failure to disclose a witness or a photograph. Inculpatory statements carry such great weight with the jury, we examine them with great suspicion when there's a failure to disclose.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I think Willis is definitely on point. And the other thing that I would want to...
The rule doesn't make any distinction, though, does it?
Between
those types of statements.
The rule
would require disclosure,
correct,
and diligence on both sides,
right,
for all those things.
Correct, absolutely.
So why should it make a difference? Why should it really make a difference? Unless the difference goes to whether or not one side or the other was prejudiced by the late disclosure.
I think, again, the difference goes to the willfulness. Say that in terms of defense counsel not asking for a continuance, in the motion the defense counsel in fact did say that requested the court to take any actions that it thought was necessary, and so that would include a continuance. And so at no point did defense counsel say all or nothing, only exclusion. But in terms of why does it matter that there's a confession instead of just a late disclosed witness that was cumulative, again, it goes to what is the purpose of a sanction? What is the purpose of excluding that evidence? And it's really to tell the state or defense counsel, if they're violating such rules, that you must adhere to these rules that would create an uneven playing field. And a confession isn't the same as something that would be cumulative, something that would be minor. And so I think that's where the sanction comes in, that and why it would be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
The jail calls are a different sort of animal than if this had been a recorded statement taken by the police, in this case, of the defendant. The Forestdale Police Department is the one that investigated this case, is the one that officer is the one that arrested defendant. And defendant was put in the Warren County Jail for pretrial detention until she made bond. She makes this call months before even the information is filed against her. And then, of course, the call is, the record's not clear exactly which day the prosecutor became aware of the call. He said he turned it over immediately. He immediately called opposing counsel, emailed the call.
But he couldn't have if there were 20 calls and he listened to them and found only one inculpatory and only sent that, didn't send any of the others. Clearly, he had these calls for enough time to listen to them himself, but that's not an immediate turning over of them.
Well, and that's what the record is silent on. I don't read it that he had them for any length of time, and it was very obvious from the presentation he gave to the court that he knew it was urgent that he get this call, and he knew this was the call he was going.
But it was urgent. He turned over them all. The rule does not say. This is not the rule that counsel is referring to that says anything you're going to use at trial you have to turn over. This rule says any statement of defendant must be turned over. Even during the trial, he still didn't turn over the other defendant statements. He still failed to comply knowingly. He knew there were 20 calls, and he only ever turned over one. And I never heard anything in the record to explain that or even to explain the failure to get these records. He didn't say they weren't easily available. It never occurred to me to go to the jail. That's not some place we normally record things. He said, I just didn't get ready for trial till the Thursday before. And so that's when I saw it.
Well, there was a deeper explanation about multiple cases being set for trial on the same day and not knowing. And he put this all out in front of the judge, in front of defense counsel, and said that he called a shell game, that the public defender was using the multiple settings as a strategy.
I know you're well aware there's an obligation to produce discovery within 14 days, and in Meriwether we said there's an affirmative duty to take action to discover information which the prosecutor doesn't actually possess. And in that case, they said they had to use, they failed to comply with that affirmative duty, even though they had done something, because they hadn't reached out and looked for what was in other government personnel's records. Are you asking us to overrule Meriwether?
No, Meriwether wouldn't have to be overruled, but And as I said before, if this had been a statement that the police officer had taken, a recorded statement that the prosecutor didn't turn over until the Thursday before, that would be different, because knowledge of the existence of that statement would be imputed to the prosecutor.
But that's my point. Meriwether and a dozen Court of Appeals cases say that doesn't matter. Inadvertence doesn't matter. In fact, this court said inadvertence and good faith do not excuse a failure to comply with Rule 2503. So if you're asking us to say they had to know they were not turning it over and know to go look for it or else it's not a violation, you are asking us to overrule Meriwether.
Well, what I'm asking, what the state's position is, Meriwether is based on 2503C, which talks about material that's in the possession or control of other governmental personnel. The state's argument here is when it was not the Warren County Sheriff's Office that investigated this case, that is other governmental personnel that the state did not have control over in this case. The Forestville Police Department, whatever they had, the state had control. All right, we look at C. If we look at the language of C, it says the state shall use diligence and make good faith efforts to cause such materials to be made available to the defense counsel. Now, that's a real odd way of saying that the state has to use diligence to discover information. The state's position on that language is that information that is known but not controlled by the state, the prosecutor.
But no case has held that, and prior cases have held the exact opposite. So how can you not be asking us to overrule them? That you have an obligation to affirmatively discover information about when you've been requested.
Well, the state's position on Meriwether is that this language about the diligence of going out and discovering information as opposed to using diligence and good faith efforts to cause materials to be made available to the defense is two different things.
No, Kate, you don't cite any case for that, do you? That's your argument in this case that you'd like the court to adopt? You don't cite a case that has made that distinction that you're now drawing?
No, not because there's been no case that's talked about this aspect of Meriwether. And
There's a dozen Court of Appeals cases that hold the same. You have an obligation affirmatively to produce things in other governments' control, including the case where you had to go to Illinois and use not just rely on Regis, but look in the other databases.
And that's Meriwether. And that involved exculpatory information. Here we're talking about inculpatory material. But what I think where Meriwether...
And it was based on, not Brady, but 2503, so it's still directly on point.
It is. And where I think Meriwether goes a little bit askew, if you look at the quotation in Meriwether of 2503C, it stops right where, to make such material available to the defense counsel. It goes on, though. The rest of 2503C talks about if the state's efforts are unsuccessful and that material is subject to the jurisdiction of the court can shall issue suitable subpoenas to cause such material or information to be made available to the state for disclosure to the defense. Now, if the first part of 2503C is talking about discovering information rather than turning over or making available information that's already known, that last clause doesn't make sense because courts can't subpoena things they don't know anything about.
But isn't the state or the prosecutor's office in a superior position than the defendant in gathering this information, whether it be from the Forestdale Police Department or the Warren County Jail? I don't see the distinction between those two entities.
Well, there's nothing in the record, and I know of nothing in lots of cases that involve jail calls, that a defendant or a public defender or any kind of or any defense counsel can ask the jail, can I have a recording of
all
this?
But counsel, again, that's not the question here, and cases have specifically said it doesn't matter if the defendant knew about the statement or whether it was available. You have a discovery obligation, and I'm surprised you're spending all your time on this issue trying to say it's okay not to follow our rules about discovery as opposed to some of the other issues that
well, and the state's position is that the state here, the prosecutor here, did follow the rules. The rules say turn over statements by the defendant. There's also a rule that talks about a continuing obligation to supplement the discovery.
Then it's practicable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
And when the prosecutor found out about this call, discovery was supplemented.
And how about the other calls?
Well, now that the prosecutor should probably have turned over the entire recording at that point.
Those were all statements of defendant. And opposing counsel says they may have put this in context, may have explained what they were talking about, may have decided after listening to them all that they would have taken the offer that you had made, but they had no way the morning of trial and not knowing what the other call said to make a reasonable decision.
Well, and that's where the fundamental fairness aspect comes into it, because if that was truly the case, then there was no request for a continuance. None of this argument was made to the trial judge. Judge, we want to listen to the rest of these calls. Now,
did they know about the rest of the calls? Did prosecutor reveal the rest of the calls?
The prosecutor, yes. The prosecutor said, I've got a disc. I'll give the disc to you right now. Now, I know, and it was probably a confusion on the part of the prosecutor of he knew he had to give what immediately hand over what he knew he was going to ask to be introduced into evidence. The discovery rules at that point, once he became aware of it, the supplementation probably required the turning over of the rest of the disc of the other calls. Now, he I don't know if he delayed it or just didn't understand what he was supposed to have done in that case, but I would have expected on the morning of trial they did file a motion for sanctions, and the defense did, but they didn't ask for time to listen to all these calls. And on this record, it's not real clear what that would have done, because we know self-serving statements of the defendant can't be admitted into evidence.
Well, of course, how can they know, though, when they just find out about it then? I find it...
Well, and that would have been... Let's ask for a continuance. Let's make a record before the judge that we need a continuance, we need to investigate the rest of these calls. They don't do that. What I think and what the record suggests to me is it was a trial strategy decision. This is, it may not have been as damning a call as the prosecutor argued to the jury, because she never does mention meth during the call, but the way she talks about how she wants to stop doing this and wants to straighten out her life, we know she's not talking about pot, which is what the other, there was drug paraphernalia in the car, and she told the officer on the recording, the dash cam recording, that maybe there was a one-hit pipe in there. So the jury would have had to infer that this what she was referring to was the meth. In fact, on the dash cam recording, she even mentions to the officer, he shows her the baggie. He says, what's this? And she said, well, I don't know. Could be cocaine, could be meth. So, you know, there is something there that in that call that the prosecutor could have argued was inculpatory.
But here, of course, the prosecutor relied on this as sort of the centerpiece of the case and told the jury to ask for it, and the jury did in fact ask for that. Do those facts all go to fundamental fairness? And do the cases indicate if it's central, if it's referred to, and if the jury asked for it, that influences whether or not you find prejudice?
That could be one aspect to fundamental unfairness. The prosecutor did use it, did argue that it was an inculpatory statement, but we also have to look at the other side of it is what could they have done with that recording? Other than, is she going to testify, I didn't make that call, that's not me? Well, the jury's heard the dash cam video of her voice. I mean, they knew that. There was nothing really, and they didn't offer anything up to the trial court to show why they would need additional time. I think they wanted to use, and rightly so, they have the right to operate under the rules, to use the rules to try to exclude what they viewed as inculpatory statements, even though she doesn't mention meth in the recording at all. But we're not disputing that it wasn't inculpatory. So when that occurs, you would expect the defense to have wanted time to investigate it, not to rely on the rules to just completely exclude that evidence.
Counsel, going back just for a second, why wouldn't a prosecutor in good faith and with due diligence upon receiving a discovery request routinely contact law enforcement and the jail? Your opponent says that these types of calls are frequent and routine. Why wouldn't that just be a matter of course for the prosecutor to check and see, you know, were there any recorded phone calls made? Isn't that a good faith effort on behalf of the prosecutor?
Well, and I think many prosecutors do that. You run down to how many days was necessary. And on these jail calls, as much as the prosecutor knows that jail calls are made, the defense even more so probably knows that their clients that are incarcerated make jail calls. But, and in fact, the defendant in this case...
That's not our question.
Yeah.
The question is, shouldn't the state routinely be requesting these jail calls? I mean, you said it earlier. These happen all the time in all these cases. So it's real hard for me to grasp how using diligence and good faith that the prosecutor, the state, shouldn't be requesting this on a routine basis.
Well, and if there's a lengthy pretrial detention, then it gets down to, well, how often?
Well, the rule says 10 days after the request. So whatever is at the jail in that period of time would have to be turned over. And then the other rule talks about discoverable information that has to be disclosed as soon as practical. So it would be anything that would happen at the time of the request should be, and this call was at that time.
Right, and it was.
And this is exactly what Meriwether talked about. It said under Brady, you have no affirmative duty to seek out information. But under Rule 2503, you do. You have an affirmative duty to seek out information and to take action to discover information which it does not possess. I mean, it's already addressed this issue and held the other way,
right,
from what you're asking.
Well, in our position is our jail calls are just fundamentally different because they're accessible to both sides. It's not like.
But and there's prior cases also that address that and say, including from this court, saying that it. If our rule didn't apply to defendant's statements or things they could get, then it would be a pretty toothless rule. It doesn't say you have a duty to turn over material that defendant's unaware of. It says you have a duty to reveal all defendant's statements. Defendants always or almost always know they made a statement, yet we specifically require it to be turned over. That would make that pointless if you could say, but if you don't, it's okay, he already knew about it. They need to know what you know, what the statement is. They may not remember what they said. They have... your obligation is to turn it over. So, again, we'd have to reverse a lot of case law.
Well, no, the difference is this was not a statement taken as part of the investigation of the case. This is just a call. What if the person that the defendant called came in on the Thursday before trial and said, hey, the defendant made a call to me and she admitted that she possessed the meth in the car? Would a court... If time was given, or if a continuous was granted, or time was given to interview the witness, would a court have
But that's different. That's not another government personnel. And that's a different situation than the facts we have here.
If the interpretation of governmental personnel is government as a whole, as opposed to the entities that investigated the case, which...
Well, this was an entity that held the defendant, so even if you have a narrow definition, it would include here. But Meriwether, as we talked about, included Illinois, so clearly we've already held that it includes other government.
And that included criminal history information that was peculiarly available to the state, that the state had to disclose on a witness in that particular case.
Counselor, you're out of time.
Thank you.
Counsel, it seems to me that if you assume that the court holds that there was a discovery violation here and orders a new trial, that we have three choices. One, we can say the only sanction that's reasonable under these circumstances is exclusion. We could say that the only sanction that's reasonable under these circumstances is a continuance or a delay which you've gotten by virtue of appeal. And the third is we could say that the trial court gets to decide that question. Now, you're arguing for the first one, and I need to know why. What makes that a better option than me giving the trial court the decision, as the rules seem to contemplate, what the appropriate sanction ought to be?
Well, in this case, I think the case law does say that the appellate court gets to decide what the appropriate sanction should have been. And here the trial court decided...
But that standard is based abuse of discretion.
Correct.
So that's a pretty big funnel to be reviewed under.
Sure. But here the trial court decided that its remedy was no remedy at all. And so I think this court could still, under that standard...
It may have said no to the remedy requested, whatever that included. It didn't say no remedy at all. It responded to the one request...
Well, if you and I would encourage this court, go back to that motion that was filed, because the motion that was filed expressly asked the court to enter any orders that it deemed necessary for this violation. And so that
paraphrases the rule, which says you can ask for it to be excluded, a continuance, or such other relief as the court finds appropriate, some language
correct.
Like that. And that's what
correct.
Was said in the motion.
Correct. And to that point, I think this is the main issue, that even here where defense counsel did invite the trial court to enter any relief that it deemed necessary, but why defense counsel should not have to ask for a continuance, that this isn't like just asking for a mistrial and not asking for a statement to be struck from the record, because asking for a continuance has due process implications for the defendant. And so, for example, if later there's a speedy trial motion, that would be held against the defendant. And the defendant should not have to give up one constitutional right for another. In this case, it would be almost the constitutional right to have effective trial counsel. And so that's why I think this court really shouldn't hold that it's defense counsel's obligation to ask for a continuance. If the trial court wanted to do that, the trial court certainly could have done that.
Well, is that never the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Earlier, you seemed to suggest in response to Judge Fisher's question that had the court sua sponte ordered a continuance or deemed that to have been requested by the defendant, that that would have been within the judge's discretion.
Correct.
So you would not have then been able to come here and argue that the only remedy reasonable under those circumstances was exclusion.
Well, I would say it's within the judge's discretion. I wouldn't say that that would have been the correct remedy for this because, again, it was a willful violation. And so I think that, I mean, abuse of discretion, we could have still said it was an abuse of discretion. And so perhaps I misspoke when I said that it was in its discretion. But here again, I think in terms of why this should be a sanction, it's almost based on the argument that the state made here, that this delay wasn't that important, that it's really just not that big of a deal, no harm, no foul, and that maybe this attorney just was a little bit confused. But I think we need to send a message that there needs to be a fair playing field by the state and by the defense, and that you can't just ignore the rules that this court promulgated. But
why isn't a retrial with all the evidence being admissible a clear message? Why isn't that a clear message?
Because a continuance doesn't why would any other prosecutor not just continue to violate the rule if they know that the only
well, what
real
if the
penalty is delaying the trial a little bit?
Why would any defense counsel ask for a continuance if they know they can come here and ask for exclusion if they lose the trial?
Again, I think under the rule, the trial court has the possibility to order a continuance, and I still think because of constitutional reasons that shouldn't be placed on the defense attorney. So I think those are sort of two different questions.
Well, the state is arguing here that the prosecutor's duty was more narrow than you're asking us to find, and if this court were to affirmatively state again what the duty is, it might then affect whether or not a trial court could look at the prosecutor's actions as being in good faith if they failed to produce it. And so while a continuance might be appropriate here and yet avoid the parade of terribles, you're saying that prosecutors will continually just take their chances because knowing so clearly that it's a violation might affect the analysis by the trial court if this court were to so hold.
Sure, and I mean, certainly, Your Honor, this court will have to make that determination. I don't think that in this case it was unreasonable for the defense attorney to ask for the exclusion, but this court may find that a different solution is most appropriate.
Had the defense counsel received these jailhouse statements sooner, what would it have done differently, and does that matter in the context of determining whether this resulted in fundamental unfairness to have admitted the evidence?
I think yes and no. I think given the nature of the disclosure that it was a confession, I think that in itself, because it was disclosed at the last minute when defense counsel's office was closed, in itself created the fundamental unfairness. And so certainly the state says that defense counsel wasn't able to give a very concrete explanation about what she would have done, but that is part and parcel of the fact that it was disclosed so late and her office was closed at that time. In terms of what she might have done differently, I've detailed some of that in my reply brief. Someone named Ryan was mentioned in the phone call, and so certainly it could have been that defense counsel was able to call Ryan. Maybe Ryan was going to say, hey, I just deal marijuana, and so when she's talking about Ryan turned me on to this, it's just the marijuana that she's talking about. Defense counsel also maybe could have called the friend and found out more about the friend and what that relationship was. Maybe in these other calls there was other things that could have been investigated. We just don't know because of the late disclosure.
And maybe counsel would have advised the client to plead guilty.
Correct. And maybe they could have, which is detailed in the discussion of the Frey hearing, maybe they could have figured out if she could have, in fact, pleaded guilty to the treatment court and done that in Jefferson County instead of Warren County, which is what she sort of indicates that she would have been willing to do.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.